Welcome to my podcast, Why Didn't Anyone Tell Me This? With my guests, we are discussing health issues, questions you may have about your health, and debunking some of the myths around our health. And today I am talking to the wonderful Philippa Kay. And I hope you do not mind, Philippa, but I think we've got a few things in common. We are both Londoners. We are both small and we're both noisy, and we've both been talking about the size of our feet before we came on, and I'm a 4 and she's a 2. So if anyone knows where to buy nice shoes for people with small feet, please let us know. So we are both 5 feet tall and we're very passionate about the extra little inch or so. So for me, I'm actually 5'1.5". And for Philippa, I believe it's 3/4. I'm about to be measured again next week in the hospital, so I hope I haven't lost that little half. So I'm going to tell you a bit about Philippa. After qualifying as a doctor, she started having babies, all in the midst of training in pediatrics, gynecology, care of the elderly, and acute medicine, psychiatry, and then general practice. She now works as a GP in both privately and for the NHS, before running home to the chaos of a house with a husband and 3 children. Doctors Get Cancer Too is her memoir of being 39 years old, a busy doctor and mother when she was diagnosed with bowel cancer, and it was an Amazon bestseller. While her previous book, The M Word, Everything You Need to Know About Menopause, reached 2 in the Amazon charts. Breasts, an Owner's Guide was released last year. She is the medical expert for many magazines and is often on TV, including This Morning and Talk TV. Philippa made a video explaining what happens during cervical screening, a smear test. So the clip has been viewed worldwide with more than 15.4 million views. I will put a link to that and to her books in the notes for this show. So, Philippa, welcome very much to the podcast. And I know you did not always want to be a doctor. So can you tell us first about your life journey so far and how you've ended up with the career you have?
Oh, so yes, apart from a little sort of a little bit where I decided I would be a ballerina, for as long as I can remember, I've wanted to be a doctor. And at medical school interviews, they ask you why you want to be a doctor, and you're supposed to have an answer that isn't because I want to help people. But the answer is because I wanted to help people. And actually, when you ask most doctors, that is the reason. We just want to help in some way. And I was very fortunate. I had a very happy childhood. The older I get, the more I realise that how lucky that makes me. And I went to Cambridge and I studied in London. And my issue during my medical training was that I wanted to do everything apart from orthopaedics. I didn't like orthopaedics, which is joints and, you know, hip replacements and things like that. So I needed to find a job that would let me do everything and do all the bits that I'm interested in. And that's what general practice is. But whilst I was in hospitals, it was really clear to me that, and I'm old enough that it was sort of before everybody had Google on their phones when I started, and people would come into A&E with their kids with the same things. And those things, I couldn't quite work out why at the time nobody was telling each other. Why did nobody know? Why was there not a conversation about what to do when your kid had diarrhea and vomiting? Why was there not a conversation about what to do when you had heavy periods? Why was there not a conversation about what it was essentially to be human? And I thought, I can only reach this number of people every day by just being me. And how can I reach more people? And the way I thought that I could reach more people was to start writing for the press and start writing books. And for me, that's every time, everything that I do in the media is about how can I reach more people to try and help with the public health messaging. So for me, it all comes from a place of medicine.
Yes, and mine doesn't come from a place of medicine because I'm a scientist, but that urge to educate people with the knowledge that we know and that can really help them in their lives is really with me as well. And it's just so brilliant that we've got the medium now with social media, et cetera, to help with that. Now your books, you've written eight. I don't know how you've written eight. Wow, that is amazing. I'm going to read out the title so that everyone knows. So Coping with Diabetes, The Fertility Handbook, Your Pregnancy Week by Week, Baby and Child Health, The First 5 Years, The M Word, Doctors Get Cancer Too, and Breasts, An Onus Guide. How have you written so many books?
I really enjoy writing. I remember very much at school, I thought that I was a scientist and that I belonged in the labs, and I thought that arts and English and languages weren't for me. But actually, general practice is about communicating. Well, medicine is about communicating, and it's about being able to understand people and talk to people. And GPs are really good people watchers. That's what we do. We watch people, and we get to be really nosy, and to sort of have an understanding of people. And so the communication bit is the bit that I really enjoy. So my books are aimed at lay people, which means that essentially it's the sort of the patter that comes out of me when you come and see me in surgery. So I really enjoy that bit, and dare I say it, find that bit almost relaxing. And it gives me an opportunity to look at the stuff that really interests me that doesn't necessarily come up in my general practice. So things like the sort of the social anthropology bit, the bit about how society and culture impact health, and the history bit around health, and in breasts and menopause, that's really relevant. And if we use breasts as an example, that women's breasts were valued for other people, your ability to feed a child, which is about someone else, and your ability to attract a partner and maybe arouse that partner, which is about someone else. And you think, well, it's not a wonder that women don't think that the breasts belong to them, that they only view them negatively, because nobody talked about the pleasure that they might bring or how to manage them. And how the impact of history has changed bras and corsets and breast health to the extent that the end of the corset, which doctors have been talking about for a long period of time, but the end of the corset was actually about war, that all the boning needed to go for the war effort. And that, wow, to me, of the First World War. And that to me is, you know, that impact of society and culture on women's health, I think is quite unique. And it's so interesting and fascinating that for me, writing is the fun bit.
I do think if I had my time again, I don't normally like having regrets, but I think I would do sociology at uni. As you say, society and how it's interacting, those history things is brilliant. And I'm so pleased one of my sons is doing sociology. So I'm going to, by osmosis, hopefully I'll be learning from him. Now, let's start delving into some of these books in a bit more detail. So let's start with your fertility handbook. Fertility is a field I've been working in since 1987. I hate saying that because so many people I know weren't even born then. But anyway, 1987, I started working in fertility. And in your book, you cover all aspects of fertility and infertility, including treatments. So there is so many myths around helping people get pregnant. What do you think is the most important advice you would give someone trying to conceive?
So that book was an interesting book because that was a book, those first two books were books that I was asked to write to fill a need. And when it comes to fertility in particular, that book, the truth is that book is out of date now because the world moves on so much. But it was about it's so scary for people and it's so emotionally charged from the second that you walk into the GP room, but actually from before that, when you thought about, do I need to make an appointment? And just, let's just use some simple language to talk about what the hell is going on. My most important piece of advice, I would say, is not actually about the physical, but is about the emotional and the psychological, which was, we've got to talk and we've got to be able to get the talking therapy and help that we need that goes alongside it. Because pediatrics, when I did pediatrics, they said, I remember one consultant said to me, pediatrics is a bit like veterinary medicine when it's babies. They can't talk to you. You have to get the communication the other way. And I remember thinking, no, it's not the same. But I did think, but hang on, I've got more than one patient in this room with me because the parents are patients too. they're different, but they are patients too. And when it comes to issues with fertility, you have many more than one patient in your room. Because whoever comes, and they might come as part of a couple and they might not come as part of a couple, but they also come with the voices of their mother and the pressure of their friends and their best friends had a baby and all of this stuff. And when they go and see a specialist, often what happens is that it gets really focused on the injections and this next bit and this next bit and this next bit. And I feel for me as the GP, my job is to hold you holistically as your whole person and to check that the rest of you is okay. And so I would say my most important bit is that you got to keep talking.
Yeah. So I went through 7 years of fertility treatment to have my kids, and it was very painful actually. And being the other side of the table, I'd worked in a fertility lab for years before I went on to do research, and it all been based around fertility. So to be the other side of the table was really, well, and we're going to talk about you being the other side of the table soon with the cancer, but it's very hard. And I found it very emotionally painful. We've done some research on those people who wanted to have children and didn't. And that emotional burden, I think if you've been through fertility treatment, whether you were successful or not, I think there's a burden, and there's lots of pain still about it. I mean, I can still easily start crying when I think back about what we went through to have kids. So I think it's really hard nowadays. Everyone is so much more busy. We've got so many other things we're trying to juggle before we think about trying to have children. And we're seeing this with, I'm sure you're aware, the fertility rates in different countries are going really, really low. So normally when I was young, people had 2.4 kids. And if you think about a couple, if you've got two people trying to have a kid, theoretically, they need to have two kids to keep the population just level. And what's happening, we've got a number of European countries where it's very, very close to one. Literally just above one, including Italy, and there's others that are slightly higher, Poland, Greece, which is really worrying now, because the research we're doing is that most couples do want to have 2 to 3 children, and that's not happening. So it's a really, really hard time. Let's move on to the menopause.
I think whilst I was lucky enough to not struggle getting pregnant, I have 3 children who I'm very grateful for. I've been pregnant 7 times. And the experience of recurrent miscarriage, you don't fall into the fertility gap, but you do. And yet the treatment pathways and the support pathways and everything else is not the same. And I think there is a grieving process that is not talked about, be it full fertility or miscarriage or primary fertility or secondary, that you are grieving, but you're grieving and it feels really lonely. And so for me, I can't do the ICSI for you and I can't do the IVF for you, but I can be with you in it. And that, I think, is the most important part.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. You know, when you talk to people, you do find so many people that you just didn't realize have these fertility journeys that, you know, as you said, it may look, oh, I've got three kids. But yeah, behind the scenes, there's a lot that many people go through. And I think, yeah, wonderfully as a GP to be that support for people. It's very, very hard. It's not easy. And we're leaving it later. So that's making it harder as well.
I often go into secondary schools and talk about PHSE and sex and bodies and blah 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 blah. And when you ask them, what percentage chance do you think that IVF will work? They say 80%, 90%, 100%, one cycle, done. And I think, ooh, this is a piece of information that is lacking, because there seems to be this idea of, yes, I can wait, it doesn't matter, because if I freeze my eggs and I have and I do that and I have IVF, I will definitely get pregnant at 45. And the conversation, it comes straight back into women in society, right? The conversation around, I can do X, Y, and Z, and there is all the time, and it doesn't matter, and I don't need to think about it, isn't true. And we harm women when we tell them, you can do it all. We would do better for women, I feel, if we told them the truth, which is it's really bloody hard to do it all, and that you might need help, and that's okay. But also, you don't have to do it all. And until, as women stepped out of the home into the workplace, bearing in mind that women have always worked, right? They might not have done it in a financial company, but they've always worked somehow. But as they step out of the home, until there is equality in that mental load and burden at home as well, all we're asking women is to do everything, not be half-half. So I think that we need to do a lot more.
Yes, I'm apologising for the small delay that we've got. So sorry for me interrupting Philippa a couple of times. I'd like to take up on that a bit more. I've been into schools and done a lot of teaching too. And we're just publishing some work we've done with the fertility poster that my international reproductive health education group designed many years ago. And we did a study last year with young adults to ask them what they thought of the poster. And it has some information about IVF. And as you say, they told us, we have the figures, and it's only successful about 30% of the time, et cetera, et cetera. And they told us they really did think it was 100% successful, that if they did IVF, they would get pregnant. So, and the information about miscarriage in schools, you know, that people don't realize that it is relatively common. And so that information, I think, giving that information to young people is really, really important.
Absolutely. Information is power for me. That's all it is. Information is power. And for people that say, oh, you're scaremongering, it's not scaremongering, I feel. No. It's empowering. We don't say this will happen to you. This terrible thing will happen to you. We say there's the things out there. And if they happen to you, come and ask for help. And silence doesn't help any of us.
And people aren't alone. I think that's what's important to know, that you know they don't have to suffer alone. There are other people that are going through their issues. Now, I wanted to pick up. You said about women. We are trying to do everything now. And I can remember when my children were small, and I felt I was doing everything badly. You know, I thought, why am I doing this career when it's, you know, it's affecting them, et cetera. But mine are all teenagers, and they're very proud of what I've been doing. So those feelings that I was just terrible at everything have really gone. And I can see how much my career has really been a positive influence on them. So, you know, you've done a lot when you've been bringing up a family as well. How difficult has it been for you to juggle work and being a parent?
I think the first question is that would you ask the same question to a young adult male doctor? And I think it's fascinating because I think we should, but we don't. I am very, very lucky in that I have a wonderfully supportive, helpful husband who is a school teacher, which means he's home in the school holidays, which is hugely helpful. It's huge. Not having to find and pay and send to camp every day in the school holidays and all of that stuff. And I come from a very supportive community. And whilst I live in London, I still have a village in that my siblings and my mum are all within 3 miles of each other. So I am very lucky. And yet it is still a juggle. And there are still issues. And the biggest stress of my life up until cancer, and probably after cancer, was, will the childcare fall through? Will somebody be sick? And will the dominoes of my day just absolutely collapse? Those were the biggest stresses. And I still feel I'm doing it wrong. And I still feel that I should be in one place when I should be in another place. And it doesn't matter where I am. So it doesn't matter if I'm at work feeling bad or at home feeling bad. That's what we do. And yet the only psychological theory of parenting that I can subscribe to is called the good enough theory, which means that we mustn't be perfect, actually, because if we're perfect, our children will never leave. And part of our role as a parent is to give them the tools and the skills so that they can leave and become independent adults. And so you need to just be good enough. And that if you love your kids and try your best, it will be good enough. And that works, I guess. And most of the time, I think it's probably all right. And if not, we'll just do some therapy later, because my kids are at, you know, some of my kids are at the school where my husband teaches. That's mortifying as an adolescent. And mum goes on telly and just talks about vaginas all the time. And that's mortifying as an adolescent. And, you know, it is what it is. We're doing our best.
Yeah, my kids, I've been in the newspaper when they were little. There was a report in several of the newspapers that I said that I taught my kids about sex education at a young age, and that my sons play with their willies. And I came out and said, one of my kids, they were a little bit older, and I said, I'm really sorry about this. And they said, well, it's true, we do play with our willies. Thank God. But carry on.
I'm sorry if, because it keeps cutting out, so I'm sorry if I'm interrupting you. But recently I was in one room and my three children were in another room, and I could hear they were sort of beginning to niggle at each other. But it wasn't something that I had to, I was waiting for them to deal with it. It wasn't a problem yet, until suddenly my youngest yelled out, "Your vagina's a self-cleaning oven, you're wrong." At which point I thought, I wonder what this is. And so I went in and they were having some random conversation, and somehow or other self-cleaning oven had come up. And she's right. I say that all the time. Your vagina is a self-cleaning oven. Leave it alone. And she somehow had misinterpreted what they were saying. And that was what she yelled. But what actually the bit that I felt okay about there was one, this is just a fact and that's not a problem. But two, the things that I talk about that she goes, yeah, mum, too, that somewhere it had gone in, so that when it gets challenged, be it through social media, be it through a partner, be it through a friend, that she will know on quite a deep down level something that I feel is very important. And so it made me think, actually, of all the things that we talk about and do, and that they are embarrassed about, or that it's difficult, that actually the things that are important, and more important than that, are in there somewhere. And that feels significant.
Excellent. I always say at the moment, thank goodness for Gillian Anderson and the sex education drama, because my kids think that's very cool. So when I talk about orgasms or something on social media, I just say, but I'm just doing a Gillian Anderson. So, right, we're going to go on now to the menopause. So a topic very important, and you have a best-selling book, The M Word, which covers everything about menopause. So I'd like to talk to you about a couple of the menopause questions that I've asked my other guests. What would be your main advice to women about menopause?
So I wrote the first edition of the M Word. I wrote it in the second half of 2018, which was a very different place in the menopause space to how it is now. Because you write books quite a long time before they're published. In comparison to, you know, doing a video on TikTok and putting it out 5 minutes later. It was a very different space, and it wasn't being talked about. And in particular, female pleasure and aging and sex weren't talked about. And I think that even within the menopause space, that's still something that's not talked about enough. And if it's a taboo to be a woman getting older, it's more of a taboo to be a woman getting older having sex, and even more to actually want to enjoy that sex. And I think the fact that, you know, if you can't even name it, why would you look after it? Never mind get any pleasure from it. So I think that we have come a long way, and yet not half as far as we need to go. And when with this morning we did the menopause bus and we went up and down the country talking about the menopause, the questions that the women, and the women were queuing up for hours to ask questions. And the questions were mostly, what's the menopause? How would I know if I'm there? And I thought, oh, gosh, we've been talking about this for a while. But these are the questions. So actually, for lots of groups of people, it's still not talked about at all. So whilst it might feel like if you pick up the paper, it's there every day, in actually in most households, it probably isn't. And my biggest piece of advice is not specific to the menopause. It's about women's health in general, which is the time for you to bother me is the time when it bothers you. Because people are so apologetic. I'm so sorry to disturb you, doc. I know you're so busy. And I say, well, my whole point of my job is for you to disturb me. Like, literally, that's why I sit here. And they say, but I don't know when it's bad enough. When is my heavy period bad enough? When is my period pain bad enough? How many miscarriages do I have to have? When is my menopause bad enough? And that there is no point. There is no cutoff that says when it is this bad on a scale, you have to come. When it bothers you, it bothers me. And don't wait.
That's really great advice. So this podcast is coming out on International Women's Day. So it's something for women to think about. And I think it's great. As you said, in 2018, we weren't really talking about the menopause as we are today. And it is being talked about a lot. But I do think there's so much conflicting information out there, which social media is one of those things. As you said, we can put it out that afternoon, that minute. But as a result, I personally find that there's very different narratives out there for women, especially around menopause. And so I wanted to ask you, what's your view about the very confusing narrative around hormone replacement therapy? What advice would you give women about taking it?
So the first thing that I say is that doctors weren't lying. There's this idea that doctors did something and then it was dangerous, so everybody was taken off. So doctors made a mistake. Maybe they were lying before, maybe they're lying now. Who are they being paid by? And no, guidance changes when research changes. And that's not lying. That's, we know more now than we did. And that is different. So when research comes out and it says that something that you thought was true wasn't true, that's evolution as opposed to a mistake. And so guidance then changes. But it takes a long time for information to trickle out into the real world and down through the doctors. So, and if you think about sort of some of the things that your mum or your gran told you, that their mum or gran told them, and lots of them are around period health, right? So, can you have a bath? Can you go swimming when you're on your period? You know, all these kind of things. People say to me, oh, I thought I couldn't have a coil because I haven't been pregnant. Because my mum told me, because my gran told me. And maybe there was a point in time when that was considered not right for whatever reason, but we now know more. So what I say to women about HRT, and I'm very open about the fact that my chemo put me into a premature menopause and I am on HRT, and premature menopause is a different situation, but it's often very reassuring to people to hear that the person sitting opposite you is taking that medicine, is I say, when they say to me, I don't want HRT, I say, let me just explain it to you so that you can make an informed decision. Because I need to know that the information that you are basing that decision on is right, because so much of it out there is not. I also very firmly believe that not everybody needs HRT. I do not believe that menopause is an estrogen deficiency state. Deficiency to me implies lacking. If you do not make insulin and you are diabetic, you are insulin deficient. Without it, you cannot function, so your doctor gives you insulin. If you have hypothyroidism, not enough thyroid hormone being produced, you are thyroid deficient because everybody else is supposed to have thyroxine, right? When you're 60, you are not supposed to have the estrogen levels that you had when you were 30. That doesn't mean that you're estrogen deficient, because you managed when you were 6. And actually, when you were a baby, you learnt more in that first year of life, and you developed more in that first year of life than you ever will afterwards. And your brain was not flooded with estrogen, and yet it was laying down a whole new load of connections, right? And it was being the most elastic thing ever. So you aren't, my opinion is that you're not estrogen deficient. That does not mean that you might not need help. Periods are normal. That doesn't mean you might not need help. Being pregnant is normal, and a state of health in it doesn't mean that you might not need help. And the same is true of the menopause. And so if you don't need help, marvellous, away you go. And if you do, come and ask me. And for some people, that help might be HRT. And we will talk about the risks and the benefits for you. And we, as individuals, we all have to weigh up our own individual risks versus individual benefits. And that is an individual conversation. And if we were all Toyotas and we went when we put petrol in the engine, it would be marvelous, but we're not. And advice that is given in books, in social media, is generalized. And you go to your doctor for individualized advice.
Thank you so much. Oh my goodness, you worded that fabulous. I agree with every single thing you said. We are all individual. That's the saying I think I say now more than anything. All the research I've been doing, please, we are all individual. And yes, everything on social media is generalized, even to do with exercise, you know, they're all generalizing. And then people read and think, oh, I have to do this, I have to do that. No, you don't. Do what's right for you. I'm 61. I chose not to take HRT. I just wanted to give it a go. I'm absolutely supportive of HRT. I tell all my friends who are having symptoms, go and have a go, see how you get on. I'm a big supporter of it. But for me, I was on the pill for decades. And when I stopped taking the pill, when I was trying to get pregnant, I felt totally different. I felt like a really, really different person. And I know I still had estrogen, progesterone in my body, but I just thought, wow, I really like this feeling without the pill. I actually, when I became postmenopausal, I wrote to my two long-term ex-boyfriends and said, I'm really sorry. I think I was a bit crazy for a while. And I really, post-menopause, find, people might not agree, but I feel really quite level and much more calmer than I've ever felt in my life. And I do feel that what you were saying about when you're 6, your brain's developed. I feel my brain's really developed, but I'm really, really not against it. And some women, it's their real happy pill, and they're going to take it till the day they die, and I absolutely support them in that. We've got to do what's right for us, haven't we?
We do, and I think that we are very good at being divided. Who breastfeeds and who doesn't? Who had an epidural and who doesn't? And I worry who's on HRT and who's not, that there mustn't be two factions. Because even if you're on HRT, you still got to move your body, and you know, and lifestyle factors are still important, and you can decrease your risk of breast. We'll need to be supportive and kind to each other, as opposed to you're wrong, because you're not wrong for you. And I think the sort of the militancy of you must do it one way or another isn't right. And saying that doesn't belittle anybody's experience. And I say that as somebody who writes books, but in the front of every single book, it says this is not supposed to replace the advice of your doctor in your situation. This is supposed to inform you about what the options are. And as I said, I'm on HRT, and I've been on HRT for a couple of, I'm 44 now, but I've been on HRT since they worked out that the chemo put me into premature menopause. What will I do when I'm 51? So for people who are listening, if you have a premature menopause, it's advised if you can take HRT to take it so that your body gets, your bones, your heart gets the benefit of the protective effect of estrogen. And my kind of cancer was bowel cancer, so I can take HRT. And at 51, at the average age of white women, what will my decision be? I don't know yet. Well, you know, we'll see then. But for right now, it is the right thing for me.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It's, and I loved what you said about we listen to things and read books, and that's the general view, but you go to your doctor for your individual rule. I think what's going to happen for you. I love that. That's really great. So remember, everyone, I think people have become a bit nervous and they find it hard to book an appointment with their GP. I think the COVID lockdown really caused an issue there. And I'm always encouraging everyone, go to your GP, speak to your GP. And the great thing we'll remember from you, Philippa, is it's your individual advice that you're going to get from your GP. So hang on to that, everyone, please. let's talk about what you went through with your cancer. So you wrote a book, Doctors Get Cancer Too. And hearing those words, it's cancer. It must be one of the worst things. And it's something that I think probably lots of people who haven't heard those words yet do worry about. So what has it been like being a doctor with cancer?
I had the shit cancer, literally the shit cancer. I had bowel cancer and I was 39 and it was 2019 when I was diagnosed, for just before the pandemic. And having cancer and being a young adult, my youngest was 4 at the time, and trying to find my way was absolutely the hardest thing that I have done. It has taught me an awful lot. I'm going to get upset. Ignore me if I cry. It has taught me a lot, and I've had a lot of therapy that I'm very open about. But to be 39 and to be faced with your mortality in a way that I think that the average person is not, and yet I was a doctor and had been dealing with death for, you know, 15 years before that. And doctors, you know, you're 24 and you see dead bodies and you see families in the absolute throes of grief. But I hadn't had it about me. And I wasn't at an age where, thankfully, you know, that my peers had been sick. And cancer comes for you in every aspect of your life. It came for me as a mum and as a wife and as a daughter and as a friend and as a doctor. And I really, really strove to hang on to the bits of me that I felt made me me. So I stayed working for most of it, apart from when I couldn't, you know, be that post-surgery or whatever. I stayed working and I needed to be able to have a place where I was still Dr. Philippa and not Philippa with cancer. And my patients didn't know. And as doctors, we choose what we give of ourselves to our patients. And how much is doctor and how much is sort of you? Even though we know as GPs, actually, a lot of the time it's doctor is medicine, not doctor gives medicine, because it's the talking and it's the being with us that can help. But I think I can pinpoint one moment in particular where how I was as a doctor changed, and it has changed forever. And that was in my first admission. And I was having a bowel resection within a week of my diagnosis. There was no processing time. I went home and I told my kids. I told my husband on the way home and I told my kids straight away, because it was happening and it was happening right now. And I hadn't, it wasn't that I intended to hide it from them. I didn't. But there was no sort of breathing. And it was in about day 5 in ICU and things were not going well. And it was the early hours of the morning, and I looked at my own heart monitor and wondered if I was going to die. In a sort of rather detached way, actually. And when you're in ICU, you have one-to-one nursing. And the nurse was there. And straight away, they called the doctor. And the doctor took probably maximum a minute. But in that time, and I don't know his name, and it really bothers me that I don't know his name because he has been so important in my life. But he sat on the bed and he held my hand and he said, "You're having a really shit time, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he held my hand. And then he must have got up and done whatever it was that he had to do. But in that moment, he saw me as a person. And he saw that what I needed. And now, when people come to me and stuff is happening in their lives, be it medical or not medical, physical or not physical, their head goes down as they're telling you this stuff. And what I realize now is that they're not always after for me to fix it. And as a doctor, I have always been told to fix it. Maybe it's medicine, maybe it's surgery, maybe it's me, maybe it's whatever, but you've got to do something to fix it. But actually what I learned was not everything can be fixed. But I can be with you in that moment and I can see you. So when their heads go down, I reach my hand across the table and I put my hand on their arm and I say, "I see how hard it is for you." And just by doing that, their eyes come up to meet you. And I think that's what I did today. That's what I learned. So it has changed me fundamentally as a doctor, and it has changed me as a mother. I no longer make promises to my children. I no longer say, "I promise I will pick you up." I no longer say, "I promise I will be there at the concert or whatever." I say, "I'll do my best." And when they say to me, "I'm scared, mummy," I say, "I'm scared too. And we're in it together." Because to borrow the words of Glennon Doyle, we can do hard things. But my goodness, is it harder to do them when we're not alone. So when the pandemic was added into the situation and I had a 15-day day stay in hospital, 10 days of which were in ICU, in the middle of the pandemic, it added a level of cruelty to what was happening to you, to be on your own.
Oh, we're both crying now. Oh, Philippa. Oh, the trouble with doing this remotely is that you always want to give someone a hug and hold their hand. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. I'm sure a lot of people will really get support. I think my two areas where I really want to concentrate now, it's not just education, it's support. And in the menopause project we're doing, we're calling it menopause education and support. And it's, you know, you've summed it up. It's so important. We must give people support. Everyone goes through a shitty time at some point in their life. And we need people around that situation to support them and help them get through it. Right. Well, take a deep breath. Stop crying.
I was diagnosed coming up to 5 years ago. And there are lots of things in that process that I see as positive, and I am very grateful that I was an incredibly lucky find that really could have been missed or not presented until later. And I have tried to take what happened to me and do some good with it. In that, Doctors Get Cancer Too was my diary. It wasn't a book that I was commissioned to write. And when my agent found out that I was writing it and encouraged me, and the publishers encouraged me, I thought very long and hard about giving it out because it was mine. And whenever I talk about it, be it on the telly or through the book or wherever, the messages that I get are amazing in that there's always a sort of a time lag. So for some people, there'll be a time lag because they'll have had a symptom, been ignoring it, and then I've read something or heard something and then gone to the doctor, and then there's been a 2-week wait, and then they've got a diagnosis or not a diagnosis before they write to me. And I see the power in that. And the messages that I get about the book, about how it has helped. I am very grateful for the opportunity to do something which feels empowering about a situation that felt entirely out of my control. But there are still things as we have just discovered, that I can't think about and talk about without getting upset. And people feel that when you have finished your treatment, and last year for the first time in August, they said, we'll see you in a year. And that's huge. And I'm aiming for 2024 to be the first year that I don't have to have a surgery, because that hasn't been true since 2019. But the impact of such a big trauma on you and your family and your life is huge. And the fact that you might look at me and think, it's, you know, she's okay now, and I am okay now, but there is still an impact of that. And we have to do more about survivorship, because if one in two of us are going to get cancer, commonest being breast cancer, more and more of us are surviving that cancer, but we are not talking about what it is that you are left with, be that a premature menopause or lymphedema, swollen arms, or I have very little bowel left. There is a consequence of having little bowel left, right? Or the psychological consequences. We need to be, as much as we talk about diagnosis and treatment, we need to be dealing with survivorship. And that bit, I feel, is not focused on right now.
Yeah, and these experiences will never leave us. They will be with us forever. But we need to cope with them. Breasts. Let's talk about breasts. I'm holding mine now. I have admitted in the podcast that came out in January that I don't think I've ever recorded a podcast wearing a bra. My bra is something that comes off the minute I come home, and I do pay a lot of money for a bra. I get a good bra, but I just so there's no bra today. So breasts, an owner's guide. Tell us about our breasts. What do you want to tell women about their breasts?
They're yours. Let's learn to look after them. So I think women's health is this really unique space in that it is managing what it is to be a woman. And as we've talked about, you're not unwell if you are a woman. And breasts are part of that. So the focus about breasts is often on breast cancer, and it needs to be. And I'm absolutely not saying that we should not focus on that. But for the 4 out of 5 women and girls who have breast pain, we need to be talking about those things. For the lack of research into bras, when you compare the amount of research into running shoes, it's astounding to me. And I'm not saying that those two things should be equal, but if about half the population have breasts, then and the whole population, more of the population, might wear running shoes, well, shouldn't there be half the number of studies on bras and bras in pregnancy and sports bras and bras after a mastectomy and bras after a wide local excision and there isn't. And yet we know that girls give up sport. They give up sport in their teens. And one of the reasons is because of breast pain and embarrassment about breast movement, because people start making comments. And the impact of girls giving up sport is lifelong, physically and psychologically. So we need to do more about that. And that your breasts are yours. So you can get pleasure from them too. That's okay. But how do we look after them? What it is that you should look for in a bra if you want to wear one, and sort of how to manage and access all of this stuff. And that is very difficult in a society that still talks about big-breasted women as being bimbos and sort of viewing them one way and flat-chested women as another way. And there's all... You know, so the dichotomy between a woman being asked to not breastfeed her baby in her own car in a car park of a supermarket, while inside that supermarket, the images on the magazines will have been overtly sexualized. When an advert by a sports manufacturer was banned in the UK, but not in the US, and it showed normal breasts of every shape and size, but it was told that maybe people wouldn't be expecting to see breasts, and that would be, you know, might have an impact. When on social media you can show a male nipple and not a female nipple, and so there are whole accounts about just close-ups of nipples so that no one can know what kind of a nipple it might be, in the idea that it wouldn't be taken down. And the fact that just last week, by the time this is recorded, so in January, I did a live breast examination on air that showed actual breasts, not covered with nipple stickers, not covered with emojis of watermelons or pineapples. And the response was huge, because women said, I've read about it and I've seen people sort of show me over clothes, but I didn't really know. And the only way for us to know is to be having the conversation. So I want women to know a lot about breasts.
Hear, hear, again, hear, hear. I got breasts when I was 9. I started my periods when I was 9. So I've had them a long time. But yes, I always wear a bra when I go out. And we've been talking a lot about sports bras. And you know, women need to be wearing sports bras if they're doing anything that involves any jumping up and down. I see so many women during my classes that I go to, and they're sort of, you know, hitting them in the face, you know, and I can imagine the pain of that. So I'm going to do a whole podcast on bras very soon. So I'll talk more about bras. And you've also done a great cervical screening video. I will put that link in the notes to this show. So tell us about the cervical screening, the importance of that.
Yes. And I think that cervical screening and, anything involving the vagina and vulva is still absolutely shrouded in silence. And a lot of the stuff that I do on social media is to try and tell people that their vaginas don't smell like a bunch of roses, because they're not a bunch of roses. So it shouldn't. And I have a real issue with companies that are preying on that, and celebrities who produce gummies to change the smell of your vagina, and companies that even the word feminine hygiene product is a real issue. First of all, if you don't bleed, you can still be feminine. You know, if you're menopausal, if you are prepubertal, if you are trans, you can still be feminine. You can be on a form of contraception that stops you bleeding and be feminine. So bleeding is nothing to do with being feminine. And hygiene implies that you're dirty. Menstrual blood is not dirty. And that shame pervades all aspects of women's health, including cervical screening. The women who say, I'm so sorry I haven't had a waxed. I'm so sorry if I'm smelly. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And so to do a cervical smear on air, a cervical screening on air, is really important. Not just for those reasons, but also because women are worried about it being uncomfortable. They don't know what it is, and we have to show that it is okay. And yet, when I go on daytime television and I talk about genitals and I use anatomical terms, you're pretty sure that someone is counting how many times Dr. K said penis before X o'clock in the morning and might be writing to Ofcom about it. These things happen. And yet, the very fact how uncomfortable the words vagina and vulva make people tells us something really important about women's health, and comes straight back to where we were at the beginning, which is how society and culture have impacted that. And that's why we shout.
I get people, when I give a talk on women's health, to stand up and shout out vulva, because they've never stood up and shouted out vulva before. But then I get them to shout out penis too. I haven't left the penis behind. But yeah, people think they're rude words. We've got to normalise them. Now, we're down to the final questions that I ask all my guests. And I'm sure you've heard many people say to you, why didn't anyone tell me this before? And that's why I've called the podcast this. For you, what was the most common thing that people didn't know when you told them something? They said, oh, I didn't know that.
I think that it's a really difficult question, because there's so much, unfortunately, that people say that I didn't know. I think that my first one is not unique to women's health. It's about health. My first one is I didn't understand or know that feelings don't have to be either or, but they can be and. So I feel embarrassed and proud. I feel brave and fed up. I feel angry and sad, because feelings are and often it's the when feelings conflict, but we have more than one, that it feels even worse. So someone who says, I want to look after my elderly parent, I want to, I love them, and I resent it, and I feel guilty that I resent it. And all of that feels horrible because it's conflicting. And I say, feelings are and they say I didn't. That I'd given them permission to have and. But when it comes to women's health, I would say probably the biggest one was I didn't know that's not normal. Be it, my periods are so heavy, I don't go to school. My periods are so painful, I can't go to work. My childbirth was so traumatic, I can't talk about it 5 years on. I pee when I cough. I have no interest in sex. Sex is not pleasurable. I'm not even sure if I've ever had an orgasm. Something is wrong with me if I haven't had an orgasm from penetrative sex. Something's wrong with me if therefore I must be frigid. All of that, all of those. And when I say to whatever it is, that's not normal. Let's talk about it. You don't have to put up with that. They say, I didn't know. Not suffer with my periods, or I would have had better sex, or I would have whatever. They say, I didn't know. And so what it makes me think is we have to open up the conversation of being able to ask.
You've been to school, so you've done some lessons in school, so you probably know this, but we've just done a study with girls, 15-year-old girls, about their periods. And it seems that schools don't want to say the word normal. So there's this whole stigma now about, oh, you mustn't make people feel abnormal. So as a result, they're not teaching what is a normal menstrual cycle. How long is it normally between periods? So last few questions. I think you've already answered this, but you said at the beginning very much about what motivated you to want to become a doctor and the work that you're doing. But what motivates you on a daily basis when you jump out of bed? What's motivating you?
So that really hasn't changed very much since I was probably five, which is I have a real need to be the best version of whatever it is that I can do. So I will keep doing all my continuing professional development and read the research and stay up to date, because I want to be the best doctor that I can be for you. And I will keep trying to talk to impenetrable teens because I want to be the best mother that I can be for you. Now, that doesn't mean that I think that I'm the best at all, or that I'm the best at any of those things. But I have this real desire to keep trying my best. And that is different every day. But I think that it took me a long time to understand that on the days when I can only give 50%, I am still giving 100% if I give 100% of the 50% that I have, if that makes sense. So I have this drive to continually keep trying my best. And quite literally, that is the reason why I get up in the morning. And it applies to all the roles that I have. And that makes it sound really rather pious, but it's not meant like that. And I find sort of joy and satisfaction in the trying. It's not in the reaching, it's in the trying. And since I was unwell, I am just incredibly, incredibly grateful to be getting older. So when you go to, you know, you go to the supermarket and you're buying a birthday card and they're all full of, you know, making fun of people who are 50 or 60 or 90 or 100. And you go to birthday parties of aging relatives and someone goes, well, why is it an achievement to be 90? And I think some of us had to work a lot harder than others to still be here. So I am just very, very grateful to still be here.
Thank you. And that nicely segues into what makes you happy and where is your happy place?
My happy place, my spiritual happy place, is either on the water or in the mountains. And it was very important to me, especially when I was sick. The mountains for me are about being small in a place that's very big, and feeling part of something bigger, which makes everything sort of more okay in my head. But what makes me happy? Had you asked me before I'd done any therapy, I would have said something about somebody else. I would have always said my children being happy, being successful at work, you know, my parents being well, I would have made it about somebody else. And since therapy, whilst all of those things are absolutely very important to me, but I realized that those things are not about me, are they? They're about somebody else. And so what makes me happy, aside from that it is okay to, well, that you can't have it all, it is okay to not have it all, and to accept 6 out of 10 or 7 out of 10 in all areas of your life, as opposed to aiming for 10 out of 10, because if you hit 10 out of 10 in one, you're going to have 0 out of 10 in the other. So to accept less than perfection, but overall, I think that would have saved an awful lot of heartache and stress. And I would have had, you know, it would have been better for my mental health the whole way through. And it's not just me. That is a message that I sort of feel really strong about my female friends who I went to school with. It's something that we feel sort of very strongly about. But my message to people out there in general is you lose nothing by trying. You know, people say, well, how did you get into TV and how did you get into radio and how did you go? You try. And some things work and some things don't. But, you know, you just keep on trying. And that held me through chemo and everything else. And I did not go to chemo skipping and jumping and being positive, but I kept going anyway. So just keep on trucking.
Thank you so much, Philippa. I was thinking of a word to describe our conversation, and I think your words are so powerful. That was the word that just kept springing into my head. You know, they were really, really powerful, and I think they will touch many people. So thank you so much for that wonderful conversation, and I can't wait to see you in person and give you a hug. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope it helps.